I believe the two most powerful words in business are just ask.
From a base of 200 billion of assets, my target in 5 years was to get us to 300.
We struck the oil in 69, the day before Christmas Eve. On the last attempt, bang, found the oil.
Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision-making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is a British company based in Henley that was established 20 years ago by two young brothers whose dream was to design and engineer beautiful chronometers. When Giles English, one of those brothers, appeared as a guest on the Money Maze podcast last year, he brought to life the wonderful history of British watchmaking, helping to explain why the world sets its time by Greenwich Mean Time. And he captured the incredible challenge of mastering the complexities involved in making exquisitely engineered timepieces. He has said, "Never judge one of our watches until you've held it in your hand and felt the quality." And both Will Campion and I have bought a watch, and we love them. Great innovation, a tangible love for their mission, resulting in beautiful, world-class luxury wristwatches.
I drink my champagne when I'm happy and when I'm sad. Sometimes I drink it when I'm alone. When I have company, I consider it obligatory. I trifle with it when I'm not hungry and drink it when I am. Otherwise, I never touch it, unless I'm thirsty.
It's almost 50 years since Madame Lily Bollinger gave that answer in an interview to the London Daily Mail to the question, when do you drink champagne? So today we're talking champagne. We're not drinking it, as I have a shoulder operation in a few hours, and so no liquids ahead of my general anaesthetic. Plus it's 9:30 here in London, 10:30 in Champagne, where my guest is. But it's an immense pleasure to welcome today the chairman and CEO of the Bollinger Group, Etienne Bizot. Etienne, bienvenue on Money Maze podcast.
Thank you, Simon. Very pleased to join you to this podcast.
Well, I believe we're similar vintages, and I know that you studied at the Catholique d'Arts et Métiers and graduated in 85, which is the year that I graduated as well, and later studied at the HEC Business School in France, the famous business school. But I guess my first question is, did you grow up looking at the vineyards from your bedroom window?
Almost yes. Because even if my family, my father and mother, were living right in the center of Bollinger Champagne, I was in a boarding school from the age of 12 up to the age of 18, and afterwards moved to this engineering school in the north of France in Lille. So, of course, I was spending weekends in the house of Bollinger. Rode a lot, bicycle in the vineyards.
What do you remember most from your childhood?
Something which was very impressive, especially when you are 5 or 6 or 7 years old, is the champagne cellars. When you look at all these bottles, it's quite impressive to see all these bottles. And secondly, it's a little bit dark. And we were running around a bit in the cellars. The workers were not always very happy about that. But that was quite impressing for a child of 5 or 6 years old to see all these bottles laying in the cellars for so many years.
Well, we're going to turn to Bollinger in a minute, but I know you went to business school, but what did you do before you joined Bollinger full time?
First of all, as all French people at this time, we had to make a military requirement. So I spent about 18 or 20 months in the French Navy. I was fortunate to be on a boat in New Caledonia, on the other side of the planet. A great experience in management, and working with great people. And then I moved to an American company called 3M during 4 years in the medical care, because the company was 3M Healthcare, and I was based in the middle of France, working as an engineer in this business, especially to remodel completely the factory of all these medicines of 3M Healthcare in France. And then I moved 33 years ago now, in 1990, to Bollinger to start these 32 or 33 years of experience with this wonderful company.
Let's talk about Bollinger, but one thing that struck me is, just help me with the pronunciation. The English say Bollinger, but I think the French say Bollinger. How should we say it?
The beauty of this name, you can pronounce easily in all the countries where you're living. When you talk about the champagne, you said Bollinger. The people working for Bollinger say Bollinger. That used to be the same. In France, we say Bollinger. In the UK, you say Bollinger. You can all say Bolli as well. And in Germany, because as you know, Bollinger is German origin, you said Bolling. That's how you pronounce. But let's move on to Bollinger as we are English speaking today.
Well, as I did my research, I discovered that in fact, Queen Victoria made Bollinger the official champagne of the royal court in 1884. And you've been making champagne since 1829. Can you just give us a sense of the history and how you stayed one unified enterprise?
When I talk about Bollinger, I must admit that the story of Bollinger family is the most passionate, the most interesting for me, because since its foundation, 1829, the Bollinger family is still the owner of this brand and of now the group, because we'll discuss about this later on. We have other wineries in France and outside France. We should consider that there are two periods within the history of this Bollinger family. The first period will start in 1829 with its foundation up to 1941, when Jacques Bollinger, the grandson of the founder, Jacques Bollinger also, died. And during these times, they first created the brand. They had to face quite big things, quite big challenges, like the phylloxera, like the 1929 crisis. But they also started to establish the main pillars of this brand. One is something you've just said, which is the royal warrant given by Victoria to Bollinger. The second is, we own quite a big vineyards now, but the establishment of the Bollinger vineyards really took place in these times, because in 1941, Bollinger was owning, I would say, 120, 130 hectares, which is about 300 acres of vines, which makes Bollinger one of the biggest owners of vineyards, because the Bollinger family always understood, and we still do, by the way, that in order to guarantee the style and the quality of the wines, you need to control your production and you need to control your vineyards, because as soon as you produce the wine with the same grapes, that's clearly a great achievement. One other big step made by the undername Bollinger was the partnership with Menzendorf. The Bollinger has been very successful and very strong in the UK. And it's mainly linked to this long-term partnership we have with Menzendorf, which goes back to 1850, 1860. And it's still the case. And then the beauty of the works which has been done by the Bollinger family also in these times is the development of American markets, Scandinavian markets, Russian markets, and European markets. So that is the first period. And then suddenly Jacques Bollinger died in 1941 from a disease. And his wife, Mrs. Bollinger, as we call her, Tante Lily, who is, by the way, the sister of my grandmother, find herself alone at the head of the Bollinger house with her cousin. And she was really loyal, and she has always been very loyal to the spirits and the strategy implemented by her husband and her father-in-law and so on. And the spirits of it has always been to maintain the quality, but based on reality, on real factors like vineyards, like Cask, like Pinot Noir, and we come back on this. And she had the beauty of being assisted by a great cellarmaster, Monsieur Polano, and she, so Tijane took her time to travel in the UK a lot. The second edition of Mrs. Bollinger, of Tante Lily to the business, was innovations. She always considered that champagne was not a marketing wine, but anything we do to grow the business and to grow the brand has to be done with wine, which has a terroir origin. So she introduced first Les Vieilles Vignes Françaises. Les Vieilles Vignes Françaises, which is a wine which is made out of pre-phylloxera vineyard or non-grafted vineyards, which happened to be a great success. The second innovation was the Ardy. And the Ardy was her answer to the trend of, at this time, of the prestige cuvée from other houses. And she considered that with all the quality efforts that she has done on a wine, selecting the best grapes from her vineyards, vinification in cask, that she considered, and she proved it, that by aging the wines longer than usual, let's say 14 years, 15 years, we could produce a wine with a development of third aromas, which was quite unusual, to be frank, in the champagne industry, because champagne image used not to be the wine which has the ability of aging. And she was the first to introduce the fact that, come on guys, come on consumers, champagne wines has a great ability of aging, so let them age. And she released Ardy 61, and with an aging of, I would say, 14 years, so that she proved a lot. And she unfortunately died in 1976, but she passed the leadership of the business of the brands to two of her nephew, because she had no children, which means Claude Dautefeuille and my father Christian. So Claude Dautefeuille ran the brand between 71 to 79, and my father ran the brand from 71 up to 1990. So at the end, this house and this group now, because it's now a group of different wineries, is still owned by the same family, 193 years now. And my aim, and I think we could manage it, is to go over 200 years with the same family in 2029.
Fantastic. Well, that's a lovely history, and thank you. So we're going to talk about branding, and where better place to start than James Bond. The association, I understand, is a 40-year partnership and 14 films, and I have had the pleasure in my research of going back over some of these films that I've watched so many times, I'd be a sad person to reveal the actual number. But my understanding is that at some point, Albert Broccoli, who was making the Bond films, visits the winery and has dinner with your uncle, and it was a great success and everything started. Now, is that folklore or fact?
Yeah, you're right. The beauty of this partnership, it's based on the relationship between two families, the Broccoli family and the Bollinger family. And it lays on this, on this private relationship. So it started in 40 years ago when Kobe Broccoli met with my father, Christian. So they get along together and they move on. The relationship is between Barbara Broccoli and Michael Wilson and myself, but also all the team of Bollinger together with a team of Yen Production. And what I like in this relationship, it has been a long-term one. And if you want to characterize a bit the way we work in our family, is we're successful as soon as we are loyal to a partnership all over the world. And James Bond is clearly one of it. We have other one. We mentioned Menzendorf, 170 years of working together. And that's the beauty of the strengths of the brand of Bollinger, is this long-term partnership. And James Bond is one of it.
Right. Well, I was very delighted to reconnect with Roger Moore asking for the 73 Bollinger in Live and Let Die, through to Daniel Craig asking for the Grand Année along with his Beluga Caviar. So tell me a little bit about how you would like the brand to be understood and perceived.
What is very important for us is consistency. The consistency of the quality is clearly a major point for the brand Bollinger. That is how our customers or consumers all over the world are expecting from us. They're expecting that we maintain the quality and the style consistent during all the vintages, all the non-vintages, and so on. So that's one point. The second point is, as I said, and linked to the loyalty to Mrs. Bollinger and to the Bollinger family, Champagne is the wine. Champagne is the wine which needs to be tasted, has many other kind of great wines. And the quality of these wine is linked on a few things like terroir, like cask, like type of grapes, and so on. That's the second point. And finally, the other point is just take your time and enjoy. It's a bit the phrase that you mentioned of Tantilly when she was drinking Bollinger. Enjoy. Enjoy with Bollinger. Enjoy a good glass of Bollinger. So that's the way we like our brands to be perceived and positioned.
So let's just talk about this vintage versus non-vintage. You discussed earlier on how it was the initiative of Lily Bollinger to age the bottles. We've seen a world in the last 20 years, particularly where the extraordinary wealth that has developed across multiple geographies has created almost a super wealth. And we had Giles English of Bremont Watches talking about how some of their special collection of their luxury watches are sought after, particularly because of the uniqueness. Gary Boom, who you obviously know, the co-founder of Bordeaux Index, talked a lot about the demand for specialist wines. How do you think about that segment of the market and the types of buyers who opt for your vintages?
In order to answer, Simon, your question, I think you need to go through the kind of wines that Champagne is proposing to his customers. There are globally two kind of wines. There is non-vintage and vintage. Talking about non-vintage, it should be the signature of the house. As the vintage is also the signature of the house, but also the signature of the harvest and the vintage. And there is now a growing demand from consumers for premium wines in Champagne. Because, as I said, Tantilly was precursor in this for 50 years ago, because they understood that Champagne is now wine and it can be enjoyed exactly as a great Burgundy with a great Bordeaux, especially the premium wine. And then the premium wines, for the premium wines, you talk about vintage. As far as Bollinger is concerned, so we have basically two vintages. One is called La Grande Année, and one is called the Ardennes. When you talk about the Grande Année, for example, we're selling at the moment the 2014, and we talk about the Ardennes, we're selling now, we're just launching the 2008 vintage. But we also propose to consumers terroir wines, which means a wine which is coming from a specific piece of land. We mentioned before the Vieille Vigne Française, which is coming from half an hectare in Ailly, but the fact is it's not only coming from Ailly, one of the best parcel of vines, but also it's a pre-Phylloxera vineyard, which is an Arbre. But we also propose La Côte aux Enfants, La Côte aux Enfants, which is also a piece of land which is up in the vineyards of Ailly, which is a total of 5 hectares. It's a monopole. So we produce two kind of wines out of it. We produce a red wine, Coteau Champenois, but we also launched last year a champagne wine, a sparkling wines, which was the first time ever, coming only from these parcel of vines, and it's 100% Pinot Noir, and it's 100% Grand Cru. So there is a story to talk about this wine, which is unique. And we also launched last year what we call PNN. VZ, which is just to enhance or to demonstrate the typicity of the Pinot Noir. Because the Pinot Noir is, if there is one or two things that you need to remember on Bollinger, is that it is a specialist of Pinot Noir from the Grand Cru and Premier Cru. And it's exactly what we're doing with this PN, Pinot Noir, which means Pinot Noir. And then we attach to it the name of a village, Tossière, Verzenay, and so on. And talking about, you mentioned Bordeaux Index, they loved that we come to them with new things every year. The beauty of the PN takes is we can change, and we're changing every year, the village. So we came to them with the Côte aux Enfants. We have the Vieille Vigne Française. So we need to surprise consumers by proposing them new wines, but always linked to the DNA of Bollinger, which could be characterized by four or five major pillars. As mentioned, Pinot Noir first. The second is the Grand Premier Cru classification of our vineyards. The third is most of our wines, a part of our non-vintage, but all our vintages and premium wines are fermented in new cask. And finally, what is also very typical to Bollinger is the time we're giving the wines to age, which means we are leaving enough of time for the wines to be completely tasteable and drinkable. And that is why the Grand Denis is 7 years and the RD is 15 or 14 years. The Vieille Vigne could be 6 years. The Piantage will be 6 or 7 years. Time is a key factor for Bollinger.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come, but a quick pause. Last year, I interviewed Gary Boom, chief executive of Bordeaux Index. Wine is a great love of mine, and as he explained, Bordeaux Index has become a major disruptor in the way that wine is bought and sold, and has sought to redefine the way a wine merchant works. I've been really impressed with their business, and have been buying wine from them since that interview. So we're delighted that the Money Maze podcast is now also sponsored by Livetrade, their world-leading fine wine trading platform. Livetrade has changed the way fine wine is bought and sold worldwide. You can instantly buy and sell or place bids and offers on key wines from Bordeaux, Champagne, Italy, and other world regions. Their two-way pricing offers guaranteed trading liquidity with no fees. So I recommend you have a look at their website, Bordeaux Index/Livetrade. The Money Maze podcast is also brought to you by our final sponsor, Mintus. The world of art investing has been typically out of reach for most investors, and yet returns have been very impressive. Mintus is a new concept in art investing, giving investors the chance to own the unownable through an FCA-authorized and regulated fractionalization platform, which offers access to iconic and rare paintings from contemporary art masters like Warhol, Kondo, Francis Bacon and Basquiat, actual paintings, not digital assets. For investors seeking to diversify their portfolios through an asset class historically uncorrelated with stock market investing and with strong returns, we've been impressed with Mintus and think it merits a closer look. Now, you have a second brand, Ayala, and funnily enough, I was being entertained at Brooks Club in St. James, and it is their house champagne. Now, I understand that it's a zero dosage champagne, if I've got my research correct. So maybe could you just explain a little bit about the interest in this zero dosage, which I understand means no sugar, and what the second brand gives you?
First, I will answer your second questions. When we discussed with the previous owners of Ayala, let's say in 2004, we were looking for a brand with a different kind of position. And Ayala, which by the way was a founder of the Seneca de Grand Marc in the 20th century, Ayala was very well reputed. And it was reputed exactly for what you said, which means that they were kind of a pioneer in the zero dosage wine. But it was also the fact that this brand was proposing wine with more Chardonnay than Bollinger. And Chardonnay Blanc de Blanc, and Ayala is selling Blanc de Blanc also, but the majority of the blends of Ayala is Chardonnay, give a different taste, of course, to the wine and help us to address another kind of consumers who are more keen on drinking more freshness than when you find it in the Chardonnay. So it has been quite a successful acquisition in 2005, and we are developing, and I'm pleased that you had the ability to drink a glass of Ayala at the Brooks, but there are many other places in the world that you can taste Ayala. It's quite a very interesting development we had within the last 20 years with Ayala.
I'm working my way around so I can try it in as many places as possible.
Simon, I'll send you an email with all the address you can find somewhere. Yeah.
Okay, there will be no podcast for the next 6 months. Right. This is interesting because what we've got is the cultivation of smaller outfits. We've got different styles of champagnes. We've got different approaches driven by consumers wanting to try different things. And behind all of this is climate change. And a question from a former colleague at Morgan Stanley and very knowledgeable enophile Chris Van Aken is, to what extent is this change in climate going to require different planting of grapes, different rootstocks, and even more regional expansion?
That is a huge question. Huge question, which doesn't concern only us. It's concerned many, many other industry. But as far as the wine industry is concerned, without any doubt, we'll have to co-visit. It's going to be a challenge, without any doubt. And of course, we're working on it. Let me start by the fact that looking at Champagne, the CIVC, the Comité Interprofessionnel des Vins Champagne, has decided to really invest a lot to support growers and houses to face against this climate change. They've increased the budget for that, which is important because you cannot cope with this challenge without investing in it. So what's going to happen in the future? Maybe some great variety. I don't think it's going to change, but maybe some different clones. Maybe some different way of planting vineyards. The question of spraying water in the vineyard, which is totally forbidden at the moment in France for the AOC. Maybe that's going to be something which can happen. We'll see. But if you look long term, the beauty of Champagne is the fact that the collectivity, which means growers and houses, decided to cope collectively against the impact of the climate change. It doesn't mean that the houses themselves are also working on that. On our side, and we may talk about this a bit later, we have vineyards in our part of the world, in France and in the US, and the decision we've taken is to engage all our 900 acres of vines towards organic certifications. So that's something which we decided to do. And we also engaged in some kind of a, not certification, but some kind of engagement toward climate change. Could be electricity, could be carbon print, and you say?
Yeah, reduction of carbon footprint.
Carbon footprint. So we are on our way, which means as many companies in the wine industry, we are on our way. And it's a long way, it's a long track, but you need to start somewhere. And that's what we're doing. First, by the organic vineyards, and also by taking, we'll see what kind of commitment we can take in terms of carbon footprint. We'll see.
So we actually had Xavier Rollet on the show a year and a bit ago. And of course, he and Chêne Bleu, very different terroir, very different temperature. But he was talking about how they've changed many of their processes because of that intense heat. So let's just put the lens on Group Bollinger and their other interests. I note that the group owns Domaine Chanson in Burgundy and also vineyards in Oregon. So maybe explain the global and the growth strategy.
I think it's a question of what a family wants to do with its assets. And let's say 30 years ago, the family decided that she wants to grow in other part of Champagne. The first acquisition that the family has done was in the Loire Valley, because we also own a vineyard in the Loire Valley, which is in Saumur. But since recently, we became one of the biggest owners of vineyards in Sancerre, with 80 hectares of Sancerre, about 200 acres of vine in Sancerre, which is quite a big amount. So that was the first external acquisition, and that was in 1973. And remember, because we had the same age, I think, remember, 73 was the first petrol gas crisis, and it has affected a lot Bollinger. And the family saw that by investing in the Loire Valley, producing Crémant de Loire at this time, there could be a good way of diversification. Afterwards, the first biggest acquisition we've done was Burgundy with the Domaine Chanson. The Domaine Chanson is about 40 hectares of Premier and Grand Cru in Côte de Beaune mainly, essentially in Côte de Beaune. And maybe we can talk about Burgundy, but it's clearly the reason, of course, they're using the same grape as Champagne, which is Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, but not for the same kind of wine, of course. But it's mainly because of this terroir approach of Burgundy. Then we also moved to another brand of Champagne in 2005 with Ayala, as we discussed just before. And that's amazing. It was more an opportunity than a real strategy. The opportunity was to support the Delamain family in Cognac. And now we own the Delamain Cognac, which is a tiny brand versus many other brands. And the Delamain Cognac has a characteristic of selling only XO, which means eau de vie, which are more than 10 years old. And in the case of Delamain, it's about 20 years old eau de vie. And that was for Delamain. And then we've recently, in the middle of the confinement, in the middle of the COVID, we recently acquired this Vineyards of Ponzi in Oregon, which is clearly for us the best place to produce great Pinot Noir and Chardonnay in the United States.
Now, of course, that leaves one geography you haven't mentioned, and I'm going to smile because I'm sitting in it. And that, of course, is England, where some of your competitors like Tattinger have decided to invest. I'm not biased here because my preference will always be to drink champagne, I think. What is your perspective on this enthusiasm around really climate change, but interesting soil?
First of all, I'll be an English, a Brit. I will always favor a bit of UK wines and English wine. And I think that's smart from few invested in the UK to have invested in sparkling wine. Second, I have tasted many of them. And I do realize that, yeah, they're doing very well. They have good terroir, chalk, like in Champagne. The climate is in favor of them, that's for sure. And what is interesting is that you mentioned Champagne houses, yes, but majority of these sparkling wines are English investors. And I don't want to give names, but I've met few of them, which had been very courageous to invest in a sparkling wine operation because it is very much capital consuming sparkling wine, because planting vineyards, starting from scratch, storing bottles, which means 2, 3, 4, 5 years, building facility to produce the wine, building hospitality, because there is a growing demand of hospitality all over the world, including in the UK, and most of them have organized hospitality operation within the winery. So it's a big investment. So we haven't decided to go into this business yet for many reasons, and it's difficult for me to go into detail on that. But we are looking closely on the evolution of this sparkling wine operation in the UK, mainly because UK is our major market.
Now, the champagne that we haven't spoken about, and I'd love to understand actually when you like to drink it and which part of the market it serves, is rosé champagne.
Yeah, rosé. If Tante Lily was sitting at my place, she will say never.
Jamais.
She will say never because she always considered that it was not a great wine. That was her feeling. But we finally moved to rosé wine in 2008 when we've launched our first rosé wine. We had before La Grande Année Rosé, but for the rosé, we really launched it in 2008. It's not a fashion. It's clearly a long-term trend in the wine business. Don't talk only about champagne, but talk about Provence. Talk about, I was recently in another country, they were also saying rosé. If you take south of France, they're doing rosé as well. So it's a real trend. And it's amazing to see that, in fact, all these rosé category is considered to be positioned at the same, not the same as champagne, but the same consumption occasion as champagne, which means a bit of celebration, aperitif, nice to have when you're with friends and so on. It's a wine which has a great attraction for the new generation. And that is key for us and the key for the development of a brand.
You have the, I'm going to say luxury as a family-owned business of taking a long-term view. What are the main changes that you would expect over the next 5 to 10 years in terms of both production and consumption, by which I mean new markets, new wines, what we may not expect right now?
The main point is the impact of climate change. So it may impact the style of wines. It may impact the level of degree in the wines. And that is why I think UK is well positioned. That's for the production. And of course, wine from other part of the world could be United States, could be South Africa, could be all these countries in the world, China, how they will evolve, how they will develop. So that's one point. But I think in terms of consumption, I think the major change is linked to the ability that we have to talk directly to consumers through the social media. If I'm back 30 years ago when I come to Bollinger, we were not discussing with consumers. We were discussing to the importer, who were discussing to the shop, the restaurant, and they were talking to the consumers. And that is a big change, to have the ability of engaging directly with the consumer, not to make business with them, because, you know, there are many special needs for that, but at least to explain and engage direct relationship with them, to explain, what are we doing? What is the characteristic of the Bollinger non-vintage special cuvée? What is the Côte aux Enfants? What is the RD? What is the Vieille Vigne Française? And all these modern way of communicating with these consumers is a clearly a big difference and a big change. It started already, but it's going to improve and accelerate a bit in the future.
So I think you're hinting at something that is my next question, which is, you have invested in Bordeaux Index. We had Gary Boom as a guest on the show in a very entertaining conversation last year, which, if people listening to this episode haven't listened to it, Gary is fantastic and it's just enthralling. We've got technology underpinning Bordeaux Index, live trade, ability to trade wines in a way that hasn't existed before, and a professionalism that has come in the UK in a very fractured, fragmented, and some would say amateurish business. What does Bordeaux Index give you?
First of all, I would like to say how much I love Gary Wood. He's a great guy. I mean, enthusiastic guy. He's older than me, but he looks younger than me. I love this guy. I love the team. They are very agile. They're very dynamic. They're very entrepreneurial. And that is not the reason why we've invested in Bordeaux Index, of course, but that's what's clearly the cherry on the cake, because it's a great team. That's my point. But to answer your question, I think the reason why we invested, and I wanted personally and push my family to do it, because I believe that technology will support the connection, as we've discussed before, between the consumers and the house. As I said, I'm not saying we want to make business directly with these consumers, because we have customer flow to do it, like BI, but at least it helps us, with the help of the technology, to explain what we are doing. The second reason is, for us, clearly BI, Bordeaux Index, is among the best wine merchants in the UK, with a characteristic of selling in other continents like the United States and Asia. So that's clearly a way for us to understand this business and how can we improve the offer of Bollinger and all our other wineries for the consumers addressed by BI. And finally, the third reason is live trade. Live trade is addressing a market which is called a secondary market, which means the ability that our consumers can sell back to other consumers. And it's amazing to see that the luxury market in general is addressing this secondary market, and they're looking very closely at what's happening in the secondary market. So it's interesting to see how this secondary market is moving, is developing. It's interesting to notice that, I think without any surprise, only the best Grand Cru or the Premier Cru, the best appellation, are working in the secondary market. And also the most reputed brands, the most reputed domain. And it helps us to better attract the consumers with the right offer in terms of wine, and maybe winery to buy in the future, region to buy in the future, is to select always the ones which are the most demanding by fine wine lovers and fine wine consumers.
So before we move to some general questions, we've talked about terroir, we've talked about brand, we've talked about the whole ecosystem, but talent and people who are key in the whole Bollinger Group, and wider than that, there's a shortage of talent in lots of industries. How do you think about acquiring and retaining really good people?
Thank you, Simon, for this question, because I think it's a crucial question for the next generation, so for the next 20 or 30 years. I do think that these guys are doing the success of a winery and an industry. one of the reasons why we've put in our values entrepreneurship, you know, we have in our value entrepreneurship, it's because we believe that the young generation need to be invested in new projects, and we need to give them the opportunity for that. And I've got a nice story about that to tell you. Right in the middle of the first confinement in March 2020, the marketing director of the French market, together with a boss, came to me in my office. In fact, that was at the end of the confinement because I wasn't at home, but anyway, came to my office and said, why don't we simply produce our own gin? And I said, for different reasons, we needed a gin to replace somebody who had just left or will leave. And I said, yeah, great idea, move on. And I said to her, you come back to me and said, I need such budget. And she moved on, she carried on. The gin is launched in September 21, becoming a great success in France. The gin is called Anne. It's a French gin, it's a bio gin. And I was very keen on the success of it because it helped for her and for many people inside the business. It's a proof that we open to listen to projects, whatever they have, and whether we can support them or not. And also give a bit of sense to what she's doing and what we're doing in the business. We need to give sense why they're staying in the business when they stay. So entrepreneurship and to give sense to the business. That's amazing. That's a very nice story. I'm very pleased to tell you about it.
So Anne, it's a bio gin, very popular in France. I've not seen it in the shelves in the UK, but I'm sure it's coming if it's not there already.
It may come, Simon.
So I'm going to ask you some general questions, and I'm going to go straight back to James Bond, who famously said about the temperature champagne should be to be drunk. He said, never above 38 degrees Fahrenheit, which I think is 3.3 degrees centigrade. What's the right temperature for champagne?
For me, it's 12 degrees Celsius. If you serve it too chilled, you kill the aromas. And for me, especially in Boulanger Champagne, there are too many aromas that, I mean, it's a pity not to taste these aromas by serving our wines at 3, 4, 5, or 6 degrees Celsius. Should be served at 12, which is about the temperature that goes out of the cellar, by the way.
Fantastic. And your cellars have lovely thick walls, so they get the right temperature. But you talked about aromas, which leads me to the type of glasses, because we have the flute and we have the coupe, the bowl. And I read that the coupe was fashionable in France from the 18th century to the 1970s. And then the flute, the straight tall glass, became more popular to concentrate the aromas. How do you think about glasses and champagne?
You're right. Back in the 18th century, that was la coupe, which is very nice to look at. But the issue with the coupe of champagne is that you lose all aromas. Aromas are flowing out without getting to your nose. That is why, to be, maybe I'm going to shock you, that's why I love to taste Boulanger within wine glass. And there are many kind of wine glasses. I'm not going to go in detail on that, but at home, I always drink champagne in wine glasses.
And when is your favorite time to drink champagne?
I don't know the phrase of Tortelli, but it's going to be the same.
Okay.
With good friends or with my family and morning, afternoon, evening, and so on.
The question I wanted to ask, and that's in the context of Bordeaux Index and generally changes in behavior, is people who are seeking alternative ways to invest, forestry, land, diamonds, vintage wines. We've seen what's happened with the first growth in Bordeaux. Are you seeing a distinct new wave of buyers who are buying to invest rather than to consume?
I think the young generation are the key target for us. The young generation, to let them understand that when you talk about La Côte aux Enfants, we talk about the Grand Année or Ardy, they should have a look at these wines as much as they're looking at the Bordeaux Grand Cru or the Burgundy Grand Cru. With a great advantage, by the way, that it's still cheaper than a Grand Cru Classic Bordeaux and a Grand Cru Burgundy. So that is a good placement for these guys who are a bit wealthy. And there are many and more wealthy people around the world and wealthy young people around the world. The next challenge for us is to attract these young generation, which has started already.
And if you could give advice, we have a lot of young people who listen to the show. people who are maybe thinking about or haven't thought about going into the wine industry, and there are some great places to study in France and in Davis in California, what advice would you give to young people thinking about the world of wine and champagne as a career?
Ooh, we'll need 2 hours to talk about that, Simon. Thank you for this question. I do think that, first of all, there is a lot of opportunity in the wine industry anyway. Could be in the production, could be in selling, could be in marketing, could be in support function like HR or whatever. And there is a demanding. The wine industry is still demanding a lot of people to work within with it. They need, first of all, to be convinced that they are interesting in the wine industry. There are many, many ways to do it. Maybe to go through the WSET program, to understand what is wine, tasting wines and so on. They need to like entertainment, because wine is firstly, if especially when you sell, when you market wine, they need to like it. They need to go and meet people and to exchange with them, have a good glass of wine with them. They need to understand also how you market, and I'm not going to make you lessons now, but how we market wine. So which channel, which kind of position, which markets, which priority, which focus. And when you talk about production, there are many career possible, like analog, like vineyard masters and so on. Maybe small visits of different wineries to be sure that they want to go in. And then I think they just have to knock on the door and defend themselves, because we are always looking for people, passionate about wine.
So my final question to you, Etienne, is that we like to ask our guests, in the journey that you've traveled before and at Bollinger, what's the most valuable piece of advice you would offer to listeners?
The big difference between our wine industry and many other industries, and that makes sometimes difficult to understand for people, it's a long-term business. The impact of the decision you take on wine, don't see the effect before many years. And that is why it's always difficult to make decisions, especially when you talk about branding and so on. But within the last 13 or 34 years within the industry, I think that the long-term vision is crucial to make such a business successful worldwide.
Voila, a perfect place to stop. Thank you. I'm going to summarize as I try to do with a couple of the valuable insights that have been imparted, and I'm going to take two away from those, apart from 12 degrees Celsius for the optimal temperature of champagne. One is that your business is changing along with many others because of the ability to talk directly to consumers. And that's an important shift, which is, I suspect, only going to grow and grow. And secondly, is that for those who talk about UK wines and investment, you use the word courageous, but one shouldn't forget these are enormous investments in CapEx and investment with very uncertain outcomes as well. So we will see and we will be observing and talking, but Etienne, it's been a great pleasure. I was looking forward to this. You know, whether you're a Bond lover or not, the Bollinger story is a fantastic one. So keep on making history.
We will. Well, Simon, thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.